This is the Civil Squared Podcast, a project of the Center for the Study of Liberty. We're here to inspire one civil conversation at a time. So sit back, relax, and welcome your host, Dr. Jennifer K. Thompson.
Hi there. Thanks for joining us. Today you're going to hear my conversation with Arthur Reiser. Arthur is the Director of Criminal Justice and Civil Liberties at the R Street Institute. And Arthur works in policy research and writes on policy in crime, policing, intelligence, and privacy. And I wanted to talk to Arthur particularly about policing reform, because that's in the news so much these days. And so Arthur's got all the credentials you could want for somebody who works in policy in this area. He's got 2 law degrees. He's finishing a doctorate at Oxford and does research there on police. He has taught. So he's got, again, all the academic credentials you could want. But here's something that's really important about Arthur's background. He was a civilian police officer. He spent 21 years in the Army and was a military police officer as well. And he has also been a federal prosecutor. So he has both the theoretical and the practical experience to talk about this subject. And as you'll hear, he has a lot to say on it. We're going to talk about what's been going on in the news. We're going to talk about various proposals for police reform, about abolishing police departments, defunding police departments, holding police departments accountable, and the ways we talk about that. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. Do you think that we are, obviously we're at a point where people are asking a lot of questions about criminal justice, and we'll certainly talk about, you know, the idea of abolishing police forces and defunding police forces and that. But do you think that with what is happening now, we are at a point where we are likely to get those redefinitions and to get that rethinking of what our values are?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some places we will. I think if we do it right, yes. If we do it wrong, no. I think that what you're seeing going on in Portland and Seattle is dangerous. I hate the word progressive because it's like a dirty word now, but yeah. It really just means forward leaning. But of course, conservative has become a dirty word on the other side. Mm-hmm. But you know, we had a progressive, you know, a chief of police, the first black chief in Seattle. Black female chief in Seattle who was doing great things. I mean, if you look at Seattle, was really leading the way on police diversion and a lot of these points where we were using data to test theories. And if it didn't work, they would change gears and try something else. It was actually a great city to study and be involved in. And I'm actually from Seattle. And so, you know, the city council, because they wanted to be dramatic, you know, passed these pieces of new code that fundamentally changed the way that police were going to operate in Seattle. And she resigned. And I think that's a major problem. And I think that's not unique to Seattle. I think you're going to see many cities kind of go through this. So do I think that we're primed for some reform? I do. But I also think that we are primed for some real slidebacks. If you're looking at some of the campaigns, President Trump has done a lot of good things on criminal justice. I've been very harsh on President Trump in the past, but I'm not going to, give him credit where credit's due. The First Step Act, it was a wonderful bill that is going to do meaningful things. But if you look at some of his campaign ads now, they're pretty horrible, and they seem to be kind of going down that race baiting Barry Goldwater lane. And I'm afraid of those, what keeps me up at night, is the worry that we're going to go back to that Willie Horton era. And let's not forget who designed and perfected tough on crime. It was people like Joe Biden and Senator Harris. Those are the individuals that, we definitely started it on the right, but the Democrats really perfected it with Bill Clinton, Joe Biden, and those individuals. Everybody was on board to the human capital that we wasted in this country. And the fact that we have like lost a generation of Americans and disinherited them from the American dream, and then act all surprised that they don't want to participate anymore. We have to take some responsibility for that, especially on, I'm a center writer. We have to take responsibility for that. We haven't been true to our principles when it comes to this issue. And I really think, you know, when I say we need to redefine public safety, we need to have a new set of values. What I'm really talking about is going back to our baseline principles, which is who we are supposed to be. If you boil conservatism down to, listen, I will fully admit I want to privatize sidewalks. But in reality, you know, what is that joke with libertarians? You're not one of those libertarians that want to sell heroin and vending machines in public parks. And the litmus test proper response is, who said anything about public parks? So I think that, you know, if we really boil down, you know, the center right and the right of what we're supposed to be, we're supposed to be for limited government. That is our bedrock. And if we lose that, then everything else kind of means nothing. You basically build a house on Jell-O, and it's very hard to trust anything else. So that is the thing that I kind of always fall back to when it comes to these issues.
I mean, I think that your point about the political rhetoric is a really important one. Yeah. And you mentioned Seattle, and I feel like Portland, Seattle, the various situations that are in the headlines now, along with the political rhetoric, make it seem like police reform or criminal justice generally, there's a left-right point of view on this, right? So the people on the left, according to this kind of narrative, I suppose, are the people who are, you know, kind of defund the police, abolish the police, total free-for-alls, you know, CHOP in Seattle or whatever. And the people on the right are the law and order people. And I think like so many things, it's just such, well, one, it's too simplistic to think that that's the case, right? But I mean, look, you're a former police officer, both a civilian police officer and in the military, a prosecutor. It seems to me that if there's anybody who could argue on the side of law and order, et cetera, you could be the person doing that. But just like it's not clear left-right here, you're not, you know, kind of the flat individual who has one point of view, right? You see subtleties in these things, and you see value in some of these reform ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if you don't see nuance when you're talking about human life, you're really doing disservice not only to yourself and your intellectual, you know, just crunching abilities, but you're doing a disservice to this country. And I feel the same way about war, issues of war. I was in the Battle of Fallujah, and I was a Republican before I left for Iraq. And what really rattled me was I saw this lack of intellectual curiosity and this lack of nuance when people were spilling blood because of those mistakes. And I think we do the same thing in criminal justice land. You know, when people say the word public safety, my first response is public safety for who? You know, you and I are white. Public safety means something dramatically different to us than it does for somebody living in inner city Baltimore. My kids are black, and they really see the world differently than I do, and they were raised in privilege. But because of their experience, because of what they see, they have a different experience. So I ask, public safety for who? And what does public safety mean? I mean, public safety means I want to make sure that people don't break into my house. I want to make sure my wife's safe when she goes to the store. I want to make sure my kids have, you know, can go to school and not feel bullied. I talk about bullying in school, and people, you know, growing up in the inner city, they're talking about not getting killed in school. And so I think that there's something that we have to address. So I kind of look at these issues in layers. And so when I'm putting my public policy hat on and I'm looking at something and it's deciding what, you know, how we're going to approach this, the first question I ask is, does this promote human dignity? Because if it doesn't promote human dignity, it's not good public policy, period. And there's no way around that. And, you know, as someone who is, you know, a Jewish mother but raised Christian, that does have a central kind of theme that runs through me. And quite frankly, Jesus would be pretty pissed off if he saw the way we treated other individuals in our criminal justice system. Because let's not forget that Jesus had a really rough time in the justice system. He was not treated fairly. And also, I think this is important to point that every turn that he got, he was down the redemption and rehabilitation route, not the punishment route. I mean, you know, the story of the you know, cast the first stone, people always say, well, it's about hypocrites. No, it's not. It's about, she was guilty under law, and the punishment was stoning, and he stepped in and said, no, let's have a point of redemption. Let's have a point of rehabilitation. So the first point for me is human dignity. And the second piece for me is public safety. If it doesn't promote public safety with the capital P, capital S, public safety for who, then it's not good public policy. If it doesn't promote freedom, it's not good public policy. I mean, the worst thing the government can do to you is put handcuffs on you. And then obviously, I think that we need to be good, good stewards of taxpayers' money. But that's the last thing that I think we should be thinking about. But I think if you look at things with those lens, it forces you to look into the nuance. It forces you to think about how are these things going to be applied to my fellow Americans. And if you still think that we are the United States of America, then you should be worried about that. And I think that is kind of how I think about those issues, and what kind of controls my thought process.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at some of these reforms that, let's say, for a lot of people seem really extreme, right? They might be concerned about the issues that we're discussing, but the idea of not having a police force, right? Of abolishing the police force, or taking money away from the police force. Again, for a lot of people, those are going to seem like really, really extreme ideas. What can we learn from those kinds of proposals that might lend themselves to a more nuanced way of thinking, and also sort of a reevaluation of values in the way that you want to see that happen?
That's a great question. So I always start by saying, if I tell a reporter this, if I wanted to have a conversation about journalistic integrity, and I started the conversation by saying, let's defund and make sure no journalist gets paid. Okay, now let's have a conversation.
Right.
Who in the hell is going to have a serious conversation after that? So, you know, rhetoric matters. And when you start a conversation with defund the police, and then you're like, well, I didn't really mean that. Well, too late. You already said it.
Yeah.
So the first thing that I would say is, stop trying to make political points and start trying to make policy, good public policy, because I think if you do that, you're going to be in a better place. Excuse me. So when it comes to abolishing, defunding the police, I think that's a foolish starting point. But if your point is we need to reprioritize what police do, that's a worthy conversation, and let's have those conversations. But you don't start in an extreme and try to work. We're not buying a car here. You're not trying to negotiate a price on a car. You're trying to fix a public policy issue. There is a serious trust gap between police and their communities. But if you ask most Black folk in the inner city, do you want to defund the police, abolish the police? The vast majority will like, hell to the no, because that is, I don't want to live in chaos. I mean, stuff is already bad here. I don't want things to get worse. And if you defund the police or abolish the police, it's going to get worse. So I think you need to have a serious conversation about what does that actually mean? Abolish the police is just silly. And it's hard to even like have an intellectual conversation about it. Defund the police has some merit if you're talking about reprioritizing that money. You know, we have done a great disservice to the police, and people read my stuff and like think, oh, you're really hard on the cops. No, I'm not. Well, yes, I am. I expect excellence from police, and I want police to be excellent. But I think we have left cops in a terrible situation. They're holding that giant bag of shit that society has offered, and they do it with little pay. I mean, I just read recently that in like North or South Carolina, North Carolina, the starting salary was just over $30,000 for cops. What? Unless you're in a big city. I mean, how can you live on that? Even if you're living in rural areas. We closed all these asylums down in the 70s, and they truly were parades of horrors. And then who got left with that? Well, the idea was we're going to treat those individuals in the community. I just recently learned that a man could commit his wife into an asylum if she didn't cook him dinner at night. Well, obviously, those are things that we don't want to happen, and those are things that I'm glad we fixed. But this idea we're going to treat these people in the community, while it started as this great idea, this liberal progressive idea, what happened to all those communities when they went into budget crises? They all defunded those programs. So who got left with those issues? The police did. Who were the first to respond during the opioid epidemic? The police are. Who are there, that come during domestic violence, alcohol-related issues? Everything. The cops are. We have truly put police in a situation where we're told you have to be the jack of all trades, but we also tell them you're law enforcement first.
Yeah.
And I think those two ideas are running into each other. And if you say defund the police, and what you mean is reprioritize the police and ensure the police have the proper training and ensure that that police have social workers that they can call on and when necessary, I think that is a worthy conversation. And quite frankly, it is righteous. It's something we should be really driving for.
You made a point about law enforcement and public safety. You've said both, you've talked about both those things. And I think this is really, even if it may seem sort of pedantic to people, the distinction between those two things. To put police in the position of not first being public safety officers, like you say, capital P, capital S, but law enforcement officers. There's two very different things going on there. And one, how do we get to the point where we look at the police as law enforcement officers versus public safety or peacekeeping officers? And what's the difference between those two things?
Yeah, I mean, law enforcement is exactly what it sounds like. I mean, cops refer to themselves, and I do this sometimes. I'll say that I'm former Leo. Law enforcement officer. And so you identify that way. And when you identify a certain way, that becomes your culture. And so, you know, we say this all the time in the middle, when I was in the Army, I remember going through bayonet training. And as we were, you know, training with our bayonets, we had to sing this song that was, what makes the green grass grow? Blood, bright red blood. And we rehearsed this over and over and over again. And at the time, I was like, this is so stupid. But when I got older, I realized that what they were doing was indoctrinating us. They were trying to, you know, change the way we thought about violence because you need soldiers to be violent. And we do the same things with police officers. When you spend, you know, the vast majority of my time with firearms training was specific to making sure that my shot group was tight and that I had a good zero. When you do that for cops, you know, that you're telling them that is what's most important instead of when maybe not to shoot. And I think that when you tunnel vision these guys and these women, and then again you're surprised that we have violent police. And you know, so my big research project that I've been working on for years through the University of Oxford really, you know, tries to capture what is police culture and how do we change it. Yeah. And what I found is that what is prestigious in policing are the things that we probably don't want to be prestigious, but we're part of the problem. Every single officer said SWAT, K-9, something like that was prestigious, but it wasn't the patrol officer. It wasn't the helper. It wasn't the community oriented officer. It was the guys that, and gals that got to go out there and kick in doors. That was what was prestigious. And I think that right there is a fundamental problem that we have to get our head around. But we're part of the problem. Think about every movie you've seen. Internal affairs is always the bad guy. You know, the guys that are, and gals that are supposed to be, you know, ensuring that cops are in line, they're always seen as the bad guy. And that goes from, you know, Lethal Weapon all the way to, you know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I was just watching the Batman movies that just came out. And Commissioner Gordon has that line when he's talking to Harvey Dent, I'm not a rat. Knowing that he has bad cops on his, guess what? Commissioner Gordon is the bad guy in that movie. We don't like to think of it that way, but he is. And this is how we have to fundamentally, you know, change policing. And listen, we have done this before. This is, people say, well, you can't change culture. Bull, you can't change culture. Yes, you can. We've done it numerous times. In the 1970s, they did a poll in American people that talked about what is the most prestigious, you know, American institutions, and the military was dead last. Mm-hmm. And from the 70s to the 90s, we systematically changed the way that people thought about the military. We changed the culture of the military itself, where now it's number one. It's the number one most respected American institution across this country, and has never left that since the early 90s, if I remember the article I read correctly. And so how did we do that? Well, we did it through, you know, professional development. I ask officers about professional development, and a huge percentage of them had no idea what that even meant. The vast majority of police training goes into tactical training, not internal training of how to be a better officer. And I think fundamentally that's a problem.
Well, you were talking about changing culture. I mean, clearly it's possible to change culture within policing, because it was not the case 50 years ago, exactly. Probably 50 years ago, 60 years ago, that cops, you know, had tanks or saw themselves as, you know, I mean, your work that you talked about at Oxford, And the polling that you did, I think you said you had polled, what, 300,000 police, or is it 300?
No, I did 300 hours riding with police officers.
Okay, so I spent
300 hours with cops in cars interviewing them. So what I did was deep dive into the field training officers for the, in three cities.
So you asked police officers, does it make you feel different when you're wearing, you know, what we would think of as riot gear, you know, or military kind of gear? And they said, yes, it does make me feel different. You know, I do feel different. I don't feel the same way I would in a regular uniform. And the way that they felt different was that they knew they were more intimidating and scary. Uh-huh. And you asked them if, do you think the public perceives you that way? And they said, yes. Right. And so I know you're not putting that out there to say, look, the average police officer is some kind of tyrant in training. But look at what it does when we behave a certain way and we equip police officers a certain way. It's going to change their thinking. The same way, you know, talking about the song when you're in basic training changes the way you think, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think about this quite often where, you know, we equip police like soldiers, we train police like soldiers, we give them soldier like missions, and then don't understand why they turn into warriors instead of guardians. And, you know, the mission statement of the police is to protect and serve. The mission statement of the United States infantry is to engage the enemy in close combat and destroy them. Those are fundamentally different things. You know, in fact, all of this whole research line started when I got back from Iraq and I was in the Minneapolis airport and I saw a officer on patrol with the same rifle that I carried in the Battle of Fallujah. And that, to me, something in my brain went click, 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 click. I'm like, how did we get here? And I absolutely want cops to be equipped safely. I want them to have access to the tools they need in order to do their job. But just, you know, I don't want to get too technical here, but just think about this one little tiny fact. The AR-15 M4, the assault rifle that police routinely carry, was basically designed in Vietnam. It's a derivative of the M16, and it shoots a bullet that's called a 223. That's a civilian model, which is a very small bullet. And the reason that it fires that really small bullet, because it was designed in war in order to wound individuals, not kill individuals. Because in war, you do more damage if you can wound them, get them off the battlefield. It takes all the resources to get them, you know, healthy. And then when they go back to their communities, the public sees them, and it saps the will to fight. When in policing would something like that ever be useful? It is outrageous that we have allowed this to happen in this country. And, you know, we have laws against this. The reason the Posse Comitatus Act, well, there's actually a lot of history. The Posse Comitatus Act is very strange and around racism and Reconstruction. But in reality, we do not want soldiers policing our streets. But what we've done in this country is just turn cops into soldiers and then like, okay, there we go. And if you have to understand there's a consequence to that. And the thing from that research that really surprised me was that cops knew it was happening. They knew there was a distrust of something. Another fact that really blew me away was the vast majority of police did not want their children to be police officers in my polling, because not because it was dangerous, because they did not feel that the community supported them anymore. And I think that right there is so frustrating, that they know there's this problem, but they don't seem to have the tools to fix it. And I think that is where we need legislation. You know, that's where public policy is supposed to come in and make things better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think from what you're describing, on the one hand, we could say, well, it'd be nice if the public saw more nuance generally, and it's not a either or, right? Either we defund the police or we give the police more money and there's nothing in between. Yep. In terms of police themselves, you know, public sector unions, that kind of thing, what kind of change in attitude do we need to see on that side to get to the place where we can get more nuance?
Yeah, this is your mind, the libertarian side is going to come out. I mean, if the 82nd Airborne Division, you know, voted next week to unionize because they didn't want to deploy to the next, you know, awful place, this country would be up in arms. How in the hell did we ever allow public sector, any public sector people to unionize? I mean, you already have a monopoly on your job. You already have the Constitution of the United States says that you cannot lose your job without due process. You already have protections, way more protection than you and I have. I could be fired in a minute. And so, that's a whole other topic. But the problem, the fundamental problem with unions is that they have turned into political beasts that exist for the sake of existing and exist to promote their own agendas and not really the welfare of police. And I think we've seen this time and time again. I mean, even, we started this conversation to talk about qualified immunity. The fact that we have unions lobbying against qualified immunity reform was, quite frankly, would actually do that much. It's more of a symbolic type of thing, in my opinion. I mean, some people would disagree with me. It's pretty crazy to me. And I think it's so intellectually dishonest on our side that we, for all the reasons that we say that teachers should have limited capacity to unionize, the same things apply to cops. But for some reason, we just forget all that on the right. And we're like, oh, yeah, we're just going to allow that to happen.
Yeah. So I will admit to some skepticism about, I mean, I'm not saying that public policy doesn't matter, certainly, but I admit to some skepticism about a lot of this changing at the level of national discourse, right? Yeah. And I think when I think about where really significant changes can take place at the local level, and I think about people that I know who may be on the right or the left, I know in both cases, people are worried, right? They're worried and they think, and it's not just about policing, it's about all kinds of things, right? Public health and everything else. And I think there's a sense that so many of us have right now frustration. Like, what do I do about it? You know, I mean, well, I can put the sign up in my yard that says, here are the things that I care about, right? And enjoying watching in my own neighborhood, people putting up signs and then somebody on the other side of the street putting up another sign that's sort of clearly meant to be against that sign, right? And so, yeah, I mean, like if virtue signaling with yard signs was going to solve all our problems, they would be solved by now. But I do wonder, I mean, like, to me, it's kind of an illustration of frustration. What else do I do? You know, what else do I do to really have a kind of an impact and change things around me? When we're thinking about this with policing and particularly with criminal justice reform, you know, any individual who looks around and says, yeah, I want things to be better in my community. And I like those three questions, you know, is it promoting human dignity? Is it promoting freedom? Is it, you know, are we being good stewards of taxpayer resources? I mean, I have the right three questions, sorry. What do I do individually to try and have an impact on this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I agree with you. I think that there is a role for the federal government to do some things, but I'm skeptical of, you know, the federal government's not going to come in and save us. Every time the federal government's come in and try to save something, it's always ended up worse. You can't give me one example of the federal government making things actually better for things that are clearly in state lanes. So I agree with you. This has to be done at a local level. And the most important thing that has to be done at a local level is we have to test, new models and see what works and doesn't work. People always talk about, you know, some of the cities in New Jersey have defunded the police and there's talk about, look how great they were. But if you look a little bit deeper, it's like, well, yeah, you defunded the city police, but then the county just picked it up. And specifically the county, which is predominantly white, has white officers, now they're patrolling a predominantly black city. So maybe that isn't the best model, but maybe you're onto something. Maybe we should experiment with this a little bit. It's the great experiment of America is our ability to have different states doing different things to see what works best. But I think that you're really onto something when you say that it really is the individual, obviously voting. I'm not going to take that as cheat and say, well, you just got to vote. You do got to vote. But I think also you have to be engaged and show that you care about these issues. I mean, you know, I remember having a bad interaction with a cop when I lived in West Virginia, and I called the police chief the next day, and I was like, why are your cops, you know, treating like this? And then the response was, well, they thought you were a student. What does that matter? Why does that matter? In fact, in some ways, that makes me upset. Yeah. You know, that you're a
and it would be okay.
Yeah, you're going to treat students like crap. I mean, that is outrageous to me. So I think that you need to fundamentally care. You need to fundamentally fight injustices where you can. Mm. But ultimately, at the end of the day, If we want police chief, we want police culture to change, we have to demand that departments make fundamental changes. And those changes need to be real, and they need to change the you're not going to chief of police your way out of this. You're not going to rookie your way out of this. You need to change that core leadership in policing. You know, it's funny that I talk about militarization of the police, and then I use the military as a lot of examples about how to make it better. But one of the things that we have done in the Army is made, we call them strategic corporals, which means that we have corporals that are like 20 years old that can do things that no other force in the United States has an NCO corps like we do. And we have to do that in policing. We need our FTOs, field training officers. We need our sergeants to be true leaders. And when they see something go sideways, they need to be the ones to step up. You know, I mean, I've said this so many times now, it seems kind of hokey, but you always hear the adage of, you know, it's only a few bad apples. Mm-hmm. And I agree. It is only a few bad officers, but that's not how that saying goes. The saying is a few bad apples ruins the barrel. So, you know, Commissioner Gordon, I'm sorry, but you have rotted your barrel, and you need to do something. We need to do something about that, because until we cut that rot out, you know, it's like, there's no other thing that we would treat this way. If you had a little bit of cancer, nobody would say, oh, that's a little bit. It's only a little bit of cancer. Or what if we just take out half of the cancer? We got rid of half the cancer. Yeah. Nobody would look at that and say, well, that's a policy win. No. You have to treat the cancer. You have to kill the cancer. And the ways we do that is to ensure that unions don't get to protect officers that suck. That qualified immunity, what city are you in right now?
In Indianapolis.
All right, so if you're in Indianapolis, and today the city came out and said, we're going to indemnify all car accidents. So if you get in a car accident, we're going to pay for it, except if you're drunk driving. If you're drunk driving, then we're not going to pay for it. What would happen overnight? Oh, and by the way, we're getting rid of all the speeding laws in Indianapolis. Overnight, you would see more car accidents.
Yeah.
You would see insurance premiums would nosedive, because the market would have no real place there. And only in the extreme circumstances of DUIs would you have any real enforcement. And that's what we kind of do with qualified immunity with police, is that there has to be an extreme abuse in order to have to come in. So if we got rid of things like that and made police accountable, then the market, and I'm using air quotes for your listeners, would kind of fix itself. You would have departments be like, we can't afford this guy anymore. There's a guy that I follow in Chicago. And you should just Google this. One of the Chicago newspapers keeps track of this. They just keep track of every single abuse complaint in Chicago. And there's a guy that has like 70-something complaints. And half of them are for, you know, violence. And they have paid out hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the list is extensive. There's one guy that I just follow, because it just, like, it's like a weird, you know, a hobby of mine. It's the point of being a fetish, where I'm just like, I'm so curious of how the citizens of Chicago allow for this. But they do. They do it by not throwing out all the bums on their heads during the election. They do it from, you know, not supporting the police when they need to be supported, but holding the police accountable when they need to be accountable. So to go back full circle to your question, how do we as an individual do this? We need to hold people accountable. That is the only way things work. You know, I look at there's no difference between raising a child and supporting a police department. You love your children, you support your children, but you don't tolerate shenanigans from your kids.
Yeah.
And if you do, what do you end up? You end up with a brat. And nobody, you know, holds their baby, you know, daughter or son in their arms and says, man, I really hope you are a brat someday.
Yeah.
It just, we fundamentally have to think differently about this issue.
Yeah. Well, and in your analogy about, you know, the rotten apples or the cancer, you don't look at the person who's going to get rid of the rot or the cancer as being, you know, unsupportive, right? That's part of the therapy, is to actually make some tough decisions and do some tricky things.
And so I think take cancer out and like incubate it somewhere else.
I think when we think about the police, it's like, well, you either support the cops or you don't support the cops, right? And if you have these you have these criticisms or concerns or anything else, then you're not supporting the cops. I think that's probably true of the military too, right? If we're critical in all of it. So I think, you know, we had Bob McNamara from the Institute for Justice on occupational licensing a while back. And one of the things he said was, sometimes it's just raising your hand and saying, I care about this, right? Yeah. And having influence in the sphere that you have influence and demanding more. So,
well, I think the one thing that frustrates the hell out of me in American politics is young people are so willing to go out there and demonstrate and, you know, Godspeed, you know, that is the American way. I always think about Jefferson's quote, the tree of liberty has to be fed with the blood of patriots every 10 years. I don't think he literally meant that, but maybe he did, but it's a good, you know, visualization of we need to sweat. We need to bleed for our freedoms, but young folk are so willing to go out there and protest and, you know, at sometimes riots, but then they don't vote. I mean, I think about this all the time. If black folk voted the same rate for Obama as they voted during the Hillary Clinton Trump campaign, she would have won. You know, and we can have debate whether that would have been a good thing or a bad thing. But holy crap, to cry now about the way things are when you didn't exercise the rights that you have is really frustrating for, you know, people like me who's out there, you know, trying to actually write legislation and change these things. But then nobody holds, you know, these people accountable when it doesn't work out. He's exactly right. Bob's right. You need to raise your hand and say, I care about this. You need to do it in meaningful ways. And we also need to get out there and vote out individuals who don't seem to align with our, you know, go back to the very beginning, our values.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know you are all over the place now because you're doing a lot of interviews and everything else. If people want to read more about your work, where's the best place for them to go?
So you can just go through my profile page at R Street. Everything's there. You know, if you type in Riser, R-I-Z-E-R, and police, you'll get article. Type in Riser and Batman. It's one of my favorite articles that I wrote. Equip police more like Batman, less like G.I. Joe. That article is kind of cool because it's a pro-police article that says why militarization is bad for policing. It makes policing harder. I talk about the cultural issue, you know, a lot in that. And I use examples. So I use the example of Phil Bradford of Brailsford, which was the Pima County police officer who shot Daniel Shaver with his assault rifle. It is a great example of how police culture is corrosive. When police culture is corrosive, how it really destroys policing. That cop was actually prosecuted, and he was acquitted, and then he got his job back, and was able to get on the job for one day so he could retire with PTSD because he shot that guy. But here's a really interesting fact about that case that I think I always talk about this in every avenue I can because. If you're not mad about these issues, then you're not reading enough. So one of the things about that case that did not come out in trial is if anybody knows anything about an assault rifle, an AR-15 or M4, it has a little tiny flap on it called a dust cover. And what that thing does is exactly what it sounds like. It keeps dirt from getting inside of your weapon. But when you fire, the brass needs to go somewhere. So that dust cover opens up and the brass pops out. So this police officer had etched, I'm not sure if I can curse on your program, but he had etched into his desk cover, "You're effed." And what he was saying with that is he just fired a bullet and you're screwed is what he's basically saying. He was relishing in violence. And that right there is a perfect example of police culture gone sideways. And that young man was murdered by that police officer and he was acquitted. And so, you know, you talk about the public holding people accountable. That's another way we can hold people accountable. Stop watching TV shows and movies that show, you know, that cowboy cop. I mean, my favorite show growing up was Lethal Weapon. When I look back at it now, I'm like, he tortured that guy. That's not okay. And so I think we should, you know, really think about these issues and understand how they are affecting our country. I mean, I read an article somewhere that, you know, the thing that really helped the takedown of the mob was the movie The Godfather, because it put this out to the public, and it took something that was very secretive and made it public. And that is why I've been writing so much, is because I think we need to be aware. We need to devour this information, because at the end of the day, where criminal justice meets the rubber meets the road is where that police officer interacts with individuals in their local community. And that is why we should care so much about this issue.
The subject of criminal justice reform, and specifically of policing reform, is a really big one. And it's an important one, and it's one that, as you heard, Arthur has very strong feelings about. And that's not surprising, given his background and what he does for a living. What I took from our conversation that I think will affect other discussions I have is this point about values and deciding, when we think about our criminal justice system, what values we want it to reflect. I think we often get focused on the details of policing or incarceration and what we see in front of us. And while those things are certainly very important, it does make sense that we need to take a step back and ask, what's the goal of what we're doing in criminal justice? Arthur has some really great stuff on the difference between retribution and rehabilitation, and we'll link to a lot of that in the show notes. But I think when we have conversations about subjects like this, that have strong feelings involved and can be subjects of controversy, it's valuable for each of us to step back and say, what is it we want to accomplish in this conversation? And what is it that we're really trying to achieve? And ask the people we're talking to those questions as well. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Thanks for being there with us.
Thank you for listening to the Civil Squared Podcast, a project of the Center for the Study of Liberty, dedicated to inspiring one civil conversation at a time. Until next time, you stay civil out there.